Welcome to the Lessons from the Great Coaches podcast.
I've learned that you don't do it alone.
You learn so many different things from so many different coaches.
That's an elite learning environment.
Failure is not a problem. How you deal with it is a problem.
How to be resilient.
How important it is to infuse joy in the process of learning.
To be a good coach, you've got to give more than you take.
What an interesting life it is to be a leader.
My name is Paul Barnett, and you are listening to the Great Coaches Podcast, where we explore leadership through the lens of high-performance sport by interviewing great coaches from around the world to try and find ideas to help all of us lead better. As the podcast has grown, the great coaches we have interviewed have shared so much insight and wisdom that we decided to create episodes dedicated entirely to the ideas that have resonated with us the most. Today's episode is on the topic of underdogs, and Grant and I are joined for the discussion by Sean Murray, who has just written a fantastic book called If Gold Is Our Destiny, How a Team of Mavericks Came Together for Olympic Glory. If you would like to join us for a future episode to discuss a coaching or leadership topic that is close to your heart, then please contact us using the details in the show notes. And now, please enjoy our discussion with Sean Murray.
The Lessons from the Great Coaches Podcast.
Good morning, Sean. Maybe if you can tell us a little bit about yourself and then we can get into the story of the underdogs.
Great. Thank you, Grant. It's a pleasure to be on your show. I'm excited to talk about a team that I spend a lot of time researching and learning about and writing a book. It's the 1984 U.S. Men's Olympic Volleyball Team. And I recently published a book called If Gold Is Our Destiny, How a Team of Mavericks Came Together for Olympic Glory. And it was a fascinating process to study a team that really was a true underdog, that 2 years before the Olympics finished 13th in their sporting world championship and somehow won a gold medal. And I'm happy. Excited to kind of go into that, but just to give a little background about who I am and what I do, in addition to, you know, writing this book, I help organizations and teams reach their full potential, helping them build better teams, build better cultures, and leaders kind of get the most out of their teams and organizations. And I'm based here in the United States in Seattle, Washington, and work with mostly mid to large size companies and executive teams doing just that. And I wanted to write a book that where I studied a team, how a team became the best in the world at what they did. And I happened to have a personal connection to this team, this underdog team we're going to talk about. My father was he took on the role of, they called the team psychologist. He wasn't really a sports psychologist. He was there to try to help the team become a better team, which is a really fascinating process. You know, what do you do to bring a group of individuals together to do something that they couldn't do collectively? They couldn't do on their own, that they could only do collectively. And so my father was a part of that team as a team psychologist, and I got to know the coach of that team, Doug Beal. And when I thought about writing a book about a team, that was the first team I thought of. And I called up my friend, Doug Beal, who was the coach of the gold medal winning 84 team, U.S. men's volleyball team. And I said, Doug, I'm thinking about writing a book about that team. It was a special team. And he said, I think you're right. It was a special team and I'd love to help you. And it was his help and guidance, connecting me with the players and others that got the project started. So that's a little bit about me.
You mentioned that what you do is help leaders primarily in the corporate world, and yet you're writing a book about sports. And what's the linkage between the story of underdogs and this team and the leadership and lessons from sport?
Yeah. Well, you know, people learn, I believe, through stories. You know, I think stories are very important. I mean, you guys get this and how you do podcasts and just, it's a very human way to learn and relate to others. And I found that people love sports stories. And there's really some great analogies between especially teams in sports and teams in business, right? I mean, we can watch a a soccer or, you know, football team. The World Cup is going on, you know, probably as we speak right now. And, you know, you watch a team come together and you can learn from that and apply that to other parts of your world. And people just generally gravitate towards these stories, especially around Olympic stories, you know, connections, the emotional and connections that you don't normally get if you're just talking about maybe other business teams. And so I find that these stories resonate. And, you know, and so I thought, let's use a sports story. I actually read a book called Boys in the Boat, which is, I don't know if you guys are familiar with that story, but it's another story about an American Olympic team. It happened to be a crew team that won a gold medal in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, which was the Nazi Olympics, and they beat the Nazi boat. You know, I mean, it's just an incredible story, another underdog story. I happened to read that book and I thought, you know, there's so many great lessons in this team that I could use to teach people in business. And I find when I talk to business executives, they often use sports metaphors, right? So anyway, it was a natural fit, and people can make the leap. And so that's why I decided to write a book about a sports team, even though I'm trying to teach people in business.
So tell us the story of the team.
Well, the team is, you know, to understand this team, this is the 1984 Olympics. It was in Los Angeles. 4 years before that was probably the biggest underdog story of all time in the United States, which was the 1980 men's Olympic hockey team. And that's a story that almost everyone universally knows here in the United States. I don't know how well known it is globally, but it's because they beat the Soviet Union, which was absolutely dominant in hockey. This story that I wrote was about volleyball, and volleyball is not as popular as hockey, and the story is not as well known, but I think it has every bit the same amount of emotion and interest, and it's a very similar story in coming from so low to so high, right? From so be such an underdog to becoming the best in the world. And they did have to beat the Soviet Union. I'll have to kind of explain that, because the Soviet Union was not at, the Eastern Bloc countries were not at the 1984 Olympics. If you remember, they were boycotting that Olympics. But so I will talk a little bit about that. But so that's to understand the backdrop of this team. In the 1970s, even though volleyball was invented in the United States, the national team was severely underperforming. What would happen was, the United States had a lot of talented players, because the size of the country, the fact that volleyball was invented here, it's not that there weren't a lot of great players. California was a hotbed of volleyball. It still is today. You know, imagine the beaches of Southern California, kids growing up playing volleyball. They had players, but what the USA Volleyball at the time did was they would bring together these sort of all-star players a few months before the European tournaments in May or June, and they'd pick a team of 12 or 14 all-star players. They'd have a few practices together. They'd throw a coach at this team, and they'd go off to Europe, and they would just, they would get beat bad. And they had no success doing this, even though they had talented players. And of course, looking back on it now, you can sort of see that it's hard to get a team together quickly, especially with big egos, you know, highly talented players. They weren't gelling. They weren't a cohesive unit. They weren't on the same page, all those things. But that was the way that the U.S. did it at the time, thinking, well, we've got these great stars. Let's just get them out there, and they're going to, you know, they're going to do what they do, and they're going to win. They didn't win. One of the players in the 1970s was a gentleman named Doug Beal. And he, my father was actually working as a team psychologist with the team in the 70s. And this player, Doug Beal, thought, you know, my father's name was Don Murray. And he said, you know, this Don Murray guy that's preaching this team building, I think we need to do more of that if we want to become a better team. And we're going off, we're playing teams from Poland, from Bulgaria, from Italy, from the Soviet Union that were playing year round, that really had a team environment. And so when that that young player, Doug Beal, was just tired of being humiliated. He became the next coach, and he thought, you know, if we do this, let's do it right. Let's get a team together in a training center, spend more than a few weeks learning, and let's do some of these practices about learning about each other, building trust, creating feedback processes for the players to give feedback to the coaches to give feedback to the players, to build our communication on and off the court. So these are some of the things they started to do to become a team. Even they had talent, like, let's get better at becoming a team. And so that's where the United States was in the early 1980s, knowing that they were going to host the Olympics in 84. They'd have an automatic bid. They hadn't been to the Olympics since 1968. And they thought, well, you know, at least we're going to be in the Olympics, first time in 16 years or something like that. And so, you know, that's kind of the state of the affairs. They had a player that believed in team. They had a coach who was a former player who believed in this whole team aspect. And that's where they were about 1981 or 82.
And so, Sean, you paint the picture of they had the opportunity, but it was a long shot. So what happened then?
Yeah, it definitely was a long shot. Most people in the volleyball world didn't give this team much of a chance to medal at this Olympics. You know, in 1982, 2 years before the Olympics, the team went to Argentina for the World Cup, and they finished 13th. They had a couple matches where they were close to winning, and then they blew it. You know, things which often happens in volleyball or in sports, you know, the momentum shifts. How do you react? How do you deal when things aren't going your way on a team or in sports? That's the difference between great teams and championship teams. They're able to overcome that. They have the confidence. They have the trust. They have the resilience to overcome these swings in momentum. And so this team did not have that. You know, they went down to Argentina. They finished 13th. The Soviet Union at the time was they had won the gold medal in 1980, and they'd won the world championships, let's say, in 78, 80, and 82. So the Soviet Union was the most dominant team in the world at the time, and they won the world championships. And it was sort of as dominant as Soviet hockey was in 1980. It's the Soviet volleyball team. And so here's the U.S., you know, 13th, not even in the same league. And the coaches thought, you know, something's got to change. You know, what are we going to do? They threw around some ideas. And one idea they came up with was, you know, what this team needs is a shared significant life experience, you know, something that they do together outside of volleyball to bring them together so they get to know each other. There were a lot of personalities, strong personalities on this team. There was a bit of a divide between the East players from the Eastern part of the United States and the Western part of the United States. They called them the Easties and the Westies. There's a bit of a tribal fault lines between the different colleges where these young men went, you know, between UCLA and USC and Pepperdine, these big colleges in Southern California. So it wasn't a team that had real strong friendships across the board. There were a few pockets of strong friendships. So for all these reasons and this whole idea of resilience, they thought, let's do something outside of volleyball. The first idea was to send them to boot camp, you know, Grant. It was Let's send these young men to become Marines. You know, we'll 10 weeks of Marine training or something, or 2 weeks or whatever they could do. And they called up the Marine base, which was close by. This team was based in San Diego, and you know, the U.S. Marine Corps said, no, we're not going to put your volleyball team through our training. So they thought, okay, well, let's. And they came up with they came across this organization called Outward Bound, which actually started in the UK. And Outward Bound is an organization that takes people through an experiential learning process. Usually at the time it was 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks, with fairly long, where you go out into the wilderness and you learn skills. And as you are out there learning, surviving in some way, you're learning life skills around how to survive, how to build resilience, how to care for other people, not just yourself, but others on your team. So it's groups of people that they take these trips on. And that was the idea. The coaches said, well, they approached Outward Bound, and Outward Bound said that they would design a course for this team. And they thought it would be great if this course was in the winter, because these players were mostly from Southern California. So they were more comfortable in the warm climates. You know, they grew up playing volleyball on the beach. They weren't as familiar with the mountains, with the snow. And so they designed a 3-week course through the mountains of Utah in the Canyonlands National Park in the United States in the middle of winter in January of 1983. And the players absolutely did not want to go on this experiential learning process. You know, their feeling was, you get better at volleyball on the volleyball court. You know, why would we take time out of practicing on the volleyball court to go try to get better at volleyball by snowshoeing around Utah with 70-pound packs and snowshoes? And so they were adamantly against it. And Doug Beal, the coach, to his credit, said, no, we're going to do this. And his assistant coaches, and they ended up flying into Utah, and actually Colorado, and then driving down into Utah and getting off a bus in January of 1983, strapping on snowshoes. And all of a sudden they were, you know, 5 miles up into a pass about 8,000 feet in elevation, and complete silence. And these players were in another world all of a sudden. And they had to learn how to survive out there in the wilderness. And that experience was the beginning, in my opinion, of building towards becoming the best team in the world, not just the best team in 84, but a dominant team for about 6 years. And it started right there.
That's a fantastic story, this whole notion of building resilience through shared experience. And I wonder, Paul, are there examples in your interviews with the great coaches on underdogs and overcoming odds in the way that Sean is talking about it?
Oh, it's a great story, Sean. I mean, we interviewed Doug a couple of months back, and he really picked up the story from the Olympics forward. So it's great to hear the context and the backstory to the team that he led to that gold medal. But Grant, I do have an example of coaches talking about underdogs. And the first one comes from Sean Deitch. Now, up until early 2022, when he was sacked, Sean was actually the longest serving coach in the English Premier League. And he coached a team called Burnley. And I asked him specifically about how he was able to create such a competitive team at Burnley, given that they had much less resources than their rivals, their competitors. And I'll insert here what Sean said about underdogs, or as he referred to them at the time, positive realities. And here's that quote now from Sean.
We sort of worked on the idea of reality, really. You know, positive realities, as I call it. So I never BS the team. I wouldn't stand in front of them when you're playing Man City and go, these lot are crap, lads. I'd say, look, we know these are proper players. These are proper, proper players. But if we can make the game about us, if we can make it uncomfortable, if we can make it feel like it's not their kind of formatted game, then that just knocks them out of kilter. And if we knock them out of kilter, do a few get a bit disgruntled? Do they make, you know, it feels different, it feels awkward? And we tried to use that kind of feeling amongst a group. And then it was like, build that mentality. And what about that one that is the one? What about that game when you do beat them? What about that feeling? Where, you know, how about that? How good does that feel? So we kind of, one of the best accolades I've ever been given, I remember Pep Guardiola, he was waxing lyrical about all the teams who went to Man City and they played good football, and he won 5-0, obviously, every time, which he did eventually against us. But the first few seasons, he used to say, going to Burnley is like going to the dentist, and I was loving it. I said, I'm absolutely loving that. It was like the biggest compliment I think I've probably ever been given, you know what I mean, by someone of his prowess. And I met him a few times, we have a laugh about some of the stuff, you know. But you get what I mean? That was a compliment, because he was basically going, it's hard, it's awkward, it's uncomfortable, you know. And when you build that mentality, it becomes a bit of a badge of honour.
So thanks, Paul. Sean, over to you, and tell us what happened during or after the Outward Bound experience.
Yeah, well, the outward bound experience was really fascinating to learn about as I researched it. I mean, a couple of things stood out. One, they had to take care of each other to survive out there. And I think that's a really interesting aspect around team. And I think underdogs in general, they develop this idea that of taking care of each other and believing in each other. And that's a very, very important aspect of any underdog story, is that it's sort of us against the world. Other people don't believe in us, but we believe in each other. And I think the Outward Bound experience was the foundation of these players believing in each other. And the way that worked was, just imagine being out there in the snow. It's below freezing. You know, you're high in elevation. It's hard to breathe. You've got this pack on. You've got snowshoes. You're breaking trail, and it's someone, one of your teammates, is ahead of you breaking trail, and it makes it a lot easier. And then that person goes to the end, and now it's your turn. You've got to be out front breaking trail. And that's what they did. They would break trail as long as they could, and then they would go to the back. And so that was step one in starting to understand, okay, to get from point A to point B, we have to work together. And then when they got to their campsite, so to speak, someone had to clear the snow out. Someone had to put a tent up. Someone had to go gather firewood. Someone had to create a fire. Someone had to start cooking. To survive out there, you have just a little bit of daylight before it's going to get dark in the winter months in North America. And so they had to work hard to feed themselves, stay warm, provide a little entertainment, you know, camaraderie, and then get into their tents and survive the night, and then wake up the next morning, and then get the tent camp taken down, repacked, and on their way, because they had to keep moving. And what they did was they developed empathy for one another. They learned to serve one another. They learned about each other as humans. And in sports, there's usually a pecking order on any team based on your ability, right? If you're the starter, if you're the captain, if you are the star of the team, you're sort of higher in the pecking order. Well, this whole experience broke that down. You know, one of the best players was not necessarily going to be the best person as making the fire or cooking, whereas maybe someone who isn't a strong player all of a sudden is the go-to person to help, you know, get through this night or whatnot. And so they started to see each other as people, as humans, and relate to each other in different ways. There was one player who happened to be one of the best players on the team, wanted to leave, and he said he thought he had enough. He didn't know why he was out there. He went to the coach, Doug Beal, and he said, "I'm leaving." There was a resupply truck that met them at a certain point, and he said, "I'm driving out with I'm catching a ride on the resupply truck. I'm out of here. This is not for me." And Doug Beal said, "Well, okay, you can leave, but there's no guarantee that you're going to have a spot on this team when you come back, when we see you again in San Diego in 3 weeks. I cannot guarantee you that." And so the player, I interviewed the player. I said, "Well, how did you feel at that moment?" And he said, "You know, I really wanted to leave, but I knew Doug was going to let me leave. And I was pretty sure that Doug was going to have me back on the team because he was, you know, he was basically the star, one of the top players on the team. And so it was going to be hard for Doug to truly let him go. But he said, "You know what? I would not have the trust of my teammates if I came back. I would have lost them, and then I would not have been effective." And he realized that he had to stay. And, you know, that decision right there, he stayed, you know, and the players respected that, and they all finished together, and they came back, and all of a sudden they had this trust and this understanding, this shared experience and stories and belief in each other. And they knew what they could overcome. If they could do that, I mean, they could overcome being down 4 points in the final set, right? I mean, and so that was the beginning of the trust. And trust is a really important aspect in any sports team, I think, especially for underdogs. They had the trust and the belief in each other when they came out of that. It led to, I think, another important aspect of this team and just about any underdog, which was, how are you going to compete and win? because if you're an underdog by your very nature, you're probably lacking in something. Either you don't have a history of winning, you don't have the right strategy, you don't have something. There's some reason why you're not predicted to win. And most teams that are not doing well, they tend to look at the best teams in the world and are in their league and say, let's copy them, right? Let's just copy them, and because they're winning. And that was the original thought of this USA volleyball team coming out of this Outward Bound experience. Let's copy the Japanese, were very, very good at the time. They had won a gold medal in 72, I think it was. And so they went to the Japanese, and the Japanese were teaching all these skills with their videos and sharing with the world how they were approaching volleyball. And the American coach just thought this was strange, because why would you share your secrets? And the Japanese coach told them, he said, well, we share this information because only the Japanese can play like the Japanese. And I think what he meant by that was, well, he sort of provided an analogy. He said, it's like a copy or a Xerox copy. So you could copy how the Japanese play, but the next generation's is going to be not the same quality as the original, right? And so he thought, sure, you could copy how the Japanese play, but you'll never beat the Japanese at how the Japanese play volleyball. And that was a light bulb for Doug Beal and the U.S. team to think, okay, we've got to figure out how to play in a way that takes advantage of the unique skills and talents of our team. And I think that's something most the underdogs eventually figure out, is you don't usually beat the best team using their playbook, you use it using the underdog playbook. And so the USA had to figure out, how do we play in a way that utilizes the unique talents and skills of our players? The US players did not look like the Soviet players. They weren't really big and tall and couldn't block like the Soviet team. And so the Soviet scheme was not going to work for them. They were shorter. They tended to come from beach volleyball, so they had a lot of non-traditional ways that they approached the game. They liked to improvise. They were very creative. They were sort of like Brazilian soccer players in volleyball, because they grew up playing two-on-two on the beach, like the Brazilians grow up playing their version of soccer in Brazil, right? Futsal or whatever they call that. So they very much figured out, okay, let's not play like the Japanese. Let's not play like the Soviet Union. And in practice, they started to develop their own way. They ended up be calling the American system, and it's still used today. It's much more focused on differentiation of skills and you calling audibles, allowing all kinds of options and plays on the volleyball court. Without getting into a lot of detail, we probably don't want to get into this podcast. The basic lesson was, they figured out how to utilize their unique strengths. And I think that's what underdogs do. And it wouldn't have been possible without the Outward Bound and the trust building.
That's such a great story, Sean. Paul, I know that you've got some thoughts on this from the great coaches.
Oh, thanks, Grant. My second example comes from a lady called Carrie Graff. Now, Carrie's fascinating because she's presently a professor. She's the director of sport at the University of Canberra in Australia. But prior to that, she was a very successful player and a coach, and she coached in the WNBA in America. But she also led a team to the Australian National Championship in her first year as a coach, and that team were not expected to do as well as they did. In fact, she refers to them in this quote as underdogs. So here is Carrie Graff.
But the first thing I did was we got them together and said, who here thinks we could win the championship? And I could see the looks on the faces of the Canberra girls that were here, thinking, oh my God, is she serious? And then I went around the room and went, count up the championships we won, whether it's in under 12s or under 14s or under 16s or in the WNBL, any championships you've won on state teams. And we went around the room, and the number, I'd been a part of many, Shelley Sandy had been a part of many. So our numbers as a group of winning was in the hundreds. So suddenly everyone in the room went, wow, we know how to win, because we've got a whole lot of people in here that know how to win. And even if we haven't been a part of a WNBL championship, I won an under 12 premiership, or I won the school girls championship. So it was really setting the stage for, you do know how to win because you won. It doesn't matter if you haven't won at this level. And everything we did was about, well, how do we win this championship? And we kept that front and center, and we set goals to sit under that. But it was really about instilling some belief early that if we do these certain things, we've absolutely got the talent to win a championship. And those of us that have won, here's some of the things that we think we can do to help this team win. So it was about instilling belief, I think, and then going about a process of, you know, doing the hard work, learning and evolving as a group, and keeping our goal at the forefront without being over focused on the outcome.
So, Sean, coming back to you, how do you recreate the Outward Bound experience and the reinventing the game? If you're a local team that's not in the Olympic medal contention, how do you take the lessons from this and recreate it in a local sports team environment?
As I mentioned earlier, I think trust is an important element to establish before, and you can do that through, I think, communication. You don't have to go on an Outward Bound. You know, not everyone's going to go 3 weeks in the wilderness, but just getting your players to talk to each other and relate to each other in ways that are outside of being on the pitch or on the court or wherever you are, to relate to each other as humans, as fellow friends, as acquaintances, as so that you open up those channels of communication and trust. So I think that's step number one. And I think step number two, especially for coaches, is there's a bit of humility here that you may not be able to design from the top exactly how this team is going to be reaching its potential. Once you've got the trust, and this is how it worked with this volleyball team, it was through listening to each other and trying things out in practice that they developed this. It wasn't an overnight thing. It wasn't someone who drew it up on the whiteboard and said, I've got it. I've figured it out. Here it is. You do this. You do that. It was part of it was players saying, coach, what if I tried this? Or the coach sitting back and observing and watching a scrimmage and saying, wow, that worked really well. How can we set our team up to have that kind of play happen more? Or tell me more about why that worked well. Do you think that worked well? So asking the players, and the players would say, well, it works well because, you know, I'm coming in from the outside and I that's the way I like to come in from. So if we can set that up, and if we have another player as a decoy over here, that's going to work. You know, that these kinds of conversations, they described as an iterative process, but with the trust and the iterative process, I would say it emerged. It wasn't design from on top. This play emerged, and I haven't studied, you know, across multiple underdogs to see, but I have a feeling that what's going on with these underdog teams is they're vastly outperforming the other team and reaching and finding the potential in their players, because they may not have the skills, they may not have the legacy and history of winning, but they're getting a lot more out of the talent, and they believe in each other. And the way to do that is to let the players and the coaches together. You have to learn, be curious, try things. You can't. One of the great things Doug Beal, the coach, said about this particular part of the journey was, he said, you can't. He said, we weren't afraid to look foolish. In other words, he would put things out in international tournaments. He'd put plays and formations out where people could ridicule it because it's never been tried before. Why would you do that? That looks ridiculous. No one ever puts two players in the back of a volleyball court to receive serve. It's never been done before. You know, you always put three or four back there because it's so important to receive the serve. Well, Doug said, no, we're going to put two back there because we have two really good guys that can return serve. And then the other four players don't have to practice that, and we can spend time. And so they tried something that if it failed, it looks foolish. But he said, you know, and there were a lot of things they tried that looked foolish, but they weren't afraid. Because what did they have to lose? They were the underdogs, right? Let's try something. Maybe that's one of the advantages of the underdogs. It's like, you know, let's try it. And they, when you're on top, you don't want to mess with what you've got, you know? So the underdogs have to do that. You've got to experiment. You got to listen to your players. You got to build trust. You got to have humility, and you got to believe in each other.
Yeah, that's such a fantastic transferable lesson, that sort of test and learn when you've created an environment where people feel safe and trusted. What a fantastic story. So maybe if I can just ask you to close, Sean, with the lessons from this volleyball team into the work environment.
Well, one thing that I learned is that these teams that are successful, you have to put the success of the team above yourself. I think that was part of going all the way back to why things weren't working in the 1970s for the USA volleyball, with these all-stars that were a little too much about themselves and not enough about team. And so one of the things I talked to organizations in business and other organizations, teams that are maybe outside of sports, is that when you bring a group together, you have to understand, you know, what's your higher purpose and be able to commit to that, which sometimes means sacrificing in some way. It may mean taking on a role that's not the perfect role for you. It may mean putting in extra work. So I really understanding your role, sacrificing so that the success of the team becomes the most important thing. And if that, so there's a certain amount of shared values that you need to understand, and being able to articulate those values, you know, trust being one of them, how people treat each other, how people are going to communicate, you know, what's our system for giving feedback to each other. These are all things that if you can talk about them, write them down, spend time on your team, not just on doing the work, but on how we're working together as a team, it will pay dividends for you down the road. And then this whole idea of finding a way for the unique talents of your team to emerge and shine. I think there's a parallel for that too in the business world, you know, and if you may also find that there's someone on your team that's very talented, but doesn't share the values. You know, this is the thing that's really hard sometimes. And, you know, I didn't talk about this in the volleyball story, but there were several players that were considered the best in the United States at the time that did not want to commit to some of the values and even the structure that Doug Beal had put together for this program. And they opted out, and the team actually became better because these highly talented players left. A lot of people thought the team wouldn't do as well if these players left, but because they left, the rest of the players really bought into the values. And so you know, it's important that everyone share the values and work together towards the team success. And so, you know, those are just a few of the lessons that you can apply in the business world, whether you're trying to be successful on the soccer pitch, on the volleyball court, on the basketball court. A lot of when it comes down to humans getting together to work together, a lot of these principles and the process is the same. This is how we in the military and in any human endeavor, the secret to human success through history, through culture, is how humans collaborate and work together. And so, these lessons are transferable.
Thank you very much, Sean. That was great. And thanks, Paul, for giving us the insights from the great coaches. So, Sean, if people want to get in touch with you or find out more about what you do and how you do it, how do they do that?
Well, you can find the book at Amazon or just about anywhere where you can buy a book online. It's If Gold Is Our Destiny, How a Team of Mavericks Came Together for Olympic Glory. I also have a website at realtimeperformance.com. And I publish a blog there, and there's a link to a podcast I do called The Good Life. And you can find all my social media there too. I'm on Twitter and LinkedIn.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thanks, Grant and Paul. It was great to be here.
Hi, everyone. It's Jim here. We hope you enjoyed our discussion on underdogs with Sean Murray and found one or two things that you can bring to your own dinner table, locker room, or boardroom table for discussion. The key lessons I've taken away on the topic of underdogs were the power of developing team connections through shared experiences away from the training facilities or the clubhouse. As an underdog, looking to copy the best in the world isn't necessarily the right way to go. Instead, use the underdog playbook, where you utilize your unique talents and skills. Underdog teams outperform other teams in unlocking the potential of their members, and they achieve this through being curious, learning, and trying innovative things where you are, quote, not afraid to look foolish, end quote. And
that underdogs successfully put the team needs ahead of the individual and are willing to sacrifice in order for this to happen. Here at the Great Coaches Podcast, we are always trying to learn, so please let us know if you have any feedback. Just like Tony McLaughlin, who after listening to our Roy Hodgson interview said, "Really enjoyed this. I've always admired Roy Hodgson over the years. He's very articulate, interesting, and a humble guy." He is that, Tony. Thank you so much. It's this interaction with people all around the world who listen give us great energy. And so if you have any feedback or any comments, please let us know. And if they're positive ones, then please let your friends know too. And all the details on how you can connect with us are in the show notes or on our website, thegreatcoachespodcast.com.